Welcome back. Michael Warren Thomas here. It's Naturally Green. It's everlife.com. And it's been a beautiful week. Some nice rain. Lots of rain today. And that way we can put away the sprinklers for a little while. It has been, it's been pretty dry. I put a whole lot of plants in the ground the last couple of days just because I wanted Mother Nature to water them in. And I've got a few more to put in, divided some things, tried a few new plants that I found on sale at a nursery. Just kind of experimenting with things to see what new discoveries might have. And this time of the year, sometimes you find some great bargains at the nurseries. Some nurseries don't put anything on sale. Even as we get later in the season. But sometimes, you know, if you see they have a bunch of annuals and, you know, it gets to be after July 4th, perhaps they'll make a deal, you know, make them an offer or see if you can get, you know, two flats for the price of one. They get tired of watering them at this point. They've been watering them since May. But also it's been a short season for the nurseries because they couldn't really open until a month ago, virtually. It's been a very, very short season. So maybe consider, you know, unless they have a sale going on, just purchasing some extra plants to help support the nursery and a local small business. It has been a challenging season. The gardening season, the sort of garden center purchasing window is pretty short. You know, it's really May and June, and before that, you know, April is, well, this year was just way too cold and we were shut down. And July gets pretty hot and people are generally doing other things. So really, May and June are the key times, and a lot of May was in shutdown, so extra short season for the nurseries, but it's not too late to plant annuals. You can get those in the ground. You'll have plenty of months with them. Some years, even as late as August, if I see a lot of annuals at a nursery, I might see if I can get a deal on those and put them in the ground in August. Used to do this at my daughter's school in the city. You know, by mid to late August, people are generally not buying annuals anymore. And so I would get flats and flats and flats of them for almost nothing. And then we get all of September, all of October, maybe even part of November for flowering. And you know, the potting soil they come with helped improve the soil, and we got a couple months of flowers. It was really, I thought it was a great bargain, even that late in the season. So definitely not too late to get some annuals. You might need to cut some of them back just, one, to help in transplanting. They'll have less greenery to support with damaged roots as you break their roots and get them in the ground. And also, it'll make them a little more compact because they can get leggy as they're hanging out, waiting to be purchased in a garden center. And those leggy plants aren't going to look that great. So, depending on what it is, consider cutting it back, cutting it in half. I did that to some imagination verbena. One of my favorite verbena plants, it's an annual with really fine textured leaves, more fern-like, even than most verbena. Generally just purple, but a really a vibrant purple and a very pretty foliage. But it can be hard to find. I'm going to try to overwinter some this year and see whether I can propagate it or not. I've had great success propagating some begonias and some plectranthus, even some geraniums. Now I'm going to plant some of those cuttings out, and I'll have yet more coverage in my garden. So I probably made 30 or 40 cuts of those three plants, and it looks like probably 90% of those survived. I kept them in the cuttings, put them in potting soil in a shady spot, and they've got new growth on them. So I'm thinking the roots are growing, and I can start to plant those out. So if you have areas that are fairly large, maybe especially shady things, because the begonias and the plectranthus do well in the shade. Geraniums love the sun. If you want to fill space, try doing that with some of your plants. Make some of your own cuttings. Let them root a little bit before you get them out, maybe. Although if it's in the shade, you could put the cuttings out there. The geraniums definitely going to need to develop some roots before you put them out in the sun. But you can cover some big areas with these annuals, and it doesn't cost you anything. So experiment with propagating some of your plants. I while I was doing those, I also took some cuttings of Daphne. That I knew that would be harder to root. I'm not sure that's going to work. A shrub, Daphne, but not a particularly hardy. So maybe a little marginal in our climate. And also, those are pretty easy to. And then I was experimenting with whether I could propagate the begonias from leaves or just from the stems. And I don't think the leaves worked well. Sometimes, like African violets, you propagate from the leaf. It's just one of those experiments just to see what might happen. And the plectranthus in particular, love to have more of that. Lots of different plectranthus. I planted probably four or five different ones, and they are radically different. One is super dark green leaf with purple, kind of purple underside and stem, and a keen sort of blue purple flower. Another one looks like lamb's ears, kind of. It's sort of soft and furry foliage. Several are variegated. One is, I have is more of a creeps like a groom cover almost, with some big green leaves. So you wouldn't know these are really if you took all these different plectranthus that I have and put them, people would not guess that they were. They just don't. Doesn't look like it's possible because the leaf shape is so different, the colors are so different, the texture of the leaves are so different, the flowers. Some flower, some don't seem to flower. I haven't kept them long enough to flower. So plectranthus is the Latin name of them, but they are there are many in that family, and they all make wonderful houseplants as far as I can tell. I've kept numerous plectranthus. They're even bigger now, like small shrubs, and great plants. Look for them, this time of the year, it's one that is really easy to propagate. I got a card from Charlie Zedek. Charlie and Judy Zedek have a daylily. It's a International Daylily Society display garden in Cobbs Hill. Maybe you've done this in the past. Maybe you've heard me mention it, but never have. Or maybe you've never heard of it. But it's number one, Hillside Avenue. And so it's between school number one and the Water Authority. There's not much between those two big properties, except one house. And it's on the road up to Tejas, which is one of the City of Rochester's lodges. And that's right at the base of Washington Grove. And up above that is Cobbs Hill Reservoir. So maybe that gives you a sense of where you are. But number one, Hillside Avenue. You can park in the school parking lot, which is across that side street that goes up to Tejas. And they just ask that you, practice social distancing and bring your own mask and wear a mask, as there'll be other people there checking out the garden. Maybe bring your own water bottle because it can be kind of hot. They're going to do these in the afternoons. They always do four, and they do them over the course of July, sometimes into early August, kind of to catch the different seasons of daylilies. There's early, there's mid, there's late season daylilies. And so this coming Sunday, a week from tomorrow, July 5th, is the first of these four. There's no reservation, there's no cost, there's nothing for sale. If you see a daylily that you fall in love with, he'll take your name, and if they end up dividing it this fall, then he'll call you, and you can purchase that at that point. But there's nothing for sale. It's just a chance to see the extraordinary variety of daylilies. I think they have in the range of 250 varieties, which is kind of an insane number in a surprisingly small space. It's not a small space for most home gardens, but for 250 varieties, it really feels like a pretty small space. So it packs them in, and the colors are really extraordinary. Also, the shapes of the flowers. There's the spider daylilies that have narrow petals that come out and sort of curl backwards. There's a little dwarf, mini, almost nano daylilies, and Charlie Zedek's been doing some projects with those. So he has some of his own named varieties, and you may see some covers on some of the flowers because after he pollinates them, he'll cover them so other bees and things don't bring in outside pollen, as he's trying to cross two very specific daylilies, and so he doesn't want other pollen to get in there and contaminate the cross that he's trying to make. So you may see some of those flowers covered so that no other bees or things can get in there. And there's some other annuals and perennials usually sprinkled in the garden. It's mainly daylilies, but the astounding variety of colors and shapes and sizes and heights it's fascinating. So Sunday, it's not Sunday, but from tomorrow, July 5th, the first from 2 to 6, and then again on July 12th, 19th, and July 26th. So it's on Sunday afternoons, basically the afternoons in July, 2 to 6 p.m. Again, no reservation, no cost. Just show up at some point. You can be there in 10 minutes. Wait to and from places. You stay photographing these daylilies and stay for a few hours. But again, he requested you wear a mask, bring a water bottle, just so you can get dehydrated. And it's a full garden. Then you should go up to Washington Grove while you're right there, and up to the reservoir. I've explored that area. Washington Grove has some tremendous trees, just old growth forest, really, a couple hundred years old. These trees, and they're stunning. There's a group called the Friends of Washington Grove, and they do work in that space, taking out some of the invasive species. They've been replanting with native perennials and wildflowers. They've been working on the trails and trying to prevent erosion. Lots of things. If you want to work with a fascinating group of people, they do parties, and with the shutdown this spring, they didn't do the work parties that they normally would have, but you can look up Friends of Washington Grove and get details on what some of the next ones are. But again, make sure to be aware and be respectful of other people about social distancing. That and the wearing of masks are what's going to keep New York State and Northeast, hopefully, from going backwards, like much of the country is right now, as they have to reinstitute shutdown measures. That's something we can avoid if people wear masks and observe some social distancing. It's really very simple. It doesn't really cost anything, and the expense of going backwards our economy would be massive. It's hard enough for businesses to survive one shutdown, but a second one for a couple of months, and that's just going to really devastate the economy far as up. But we can avoid that. So if you have family or friends who live in the area or neighbors and they're not wearing a mask, not practicing social distancing, ask them, tell them, you know, this is what's going to keep us from going backwards. It's science. We know how to defeat this virus. It's just major parts of the country aren't doing it and been reluctant to do it and reopen too fast. So we need to keep us here at this level, you know, with a small number of new infections a day in New York State. We can do the contact tracing. We can do the things that are necessary to keep those numbers low when, you know, if there's a 200 new infections confirmed. And that's a number you can search out and go through their contacts and have them self quarantine. But if you're in Florida, you got 9,000 new cases a day. You can't contact trace those. You got huge problems. And those cases they know about. There are probably many other cases they don't know about. We've paid a steep price to get where we are, and we can't afford to go backwards. And hopefully you can say that to other people, whether it's a friend, neighbor, or relative. You know, say it in a way that they're not getting mad at you. Just, it's a request. It's to protect you if they wear a mask. And, you know, if they won't, you know, there's not a lot you can do about it, but asking them, reminding them, that would be worthwhile. And if you have comments, questions, you can email michael@saverlife.com. If you have plants that you can't identify, love to do some plant ID. And usually, you know, a couple photos, one close up, one further back, that's helpful. I don't know whether to pull it out of the ground or prune it or, take so you can highlight that plant. You don't know what it is. So if you want help in the nursery, go on a rainy day on a weekday. Weekends tend to be their busiest times, and maybe they can help you. But again, you got to know what these plants are. And some of the weeds are growing really well. Quite a few. There are a few weeds you need to know a little bit more about, because if you don't, you're just going to frustrate yourself from getting rid of them. One is the swallowwort. Swallowwort is growing a lot of through the parks and along paths, and it has a little seed pods that are kind of like a milkweed. It's in that family, and so those little seedlings fly around and they end up in your yard and start growing. And this plant has a very distinctive dark green kind of heavy leaf, thicker textured leaf, maybe slightly. And the leaves come out across each other from the stem. It grows very straight. It will start to turn into a vine at about 3 feet high, which is a very strange thing, actually, because it's not a vine for the first several feet of growth. And then it shoots off sort of smaller stem that starts to wind and look for something to climb. And the reason you want to identify this is that you can't pull it out of the ground. It's got a very good root system. And if you don't get the root system, you're just spreading this weed in your garden, because it will start coming up wherever those roots are growing. And it's got very white roots. Once you dig it up, it'll be pretty easy to identify and sort of dig it up carefully, trying to get as many of the roots as possible so that you don't get an infestation of this, which will ruin your garden. You'll have to take out all the perennials wherever it's growing, because you can't separate the two. You might be able to separate them once they're out of the ground and replant the perennials, but that's a pain. So you got to get to know this plant. And once you've gotten it out, you know, go back and check that area a couple months from now just to see if you missed some roots that are now have new growth. But this is a plant that will send up 1,000 little plants within a couple of years and really make a mess of your garden. So swallowwort, maybe look it up so you can see it, and then check it out as you're doing some walking, or, you know, the canal path, riverway trail. There's plenty of it there. There's also the Japanese knotweed, which gets much bigger. And that's another plant you need to identify so that you don't let it get started in your yard, or so that you don't let it come from a neighbor's yard into your yard, because that's going to be very, very hard to get rid of. So that's why we need to identify the plants in our garden, not to mention poison ivy. I took a photo just a couple days ago of a three-leaf plant that looked just like poison ivy. It was not, because it's the bishop's weed. And bishop's weed is, one, it's a weed, but it's also sold as Agapodium, which is the Latin name of it. And if you see that on the label, you don't see the name bishop's weed, you might buy it. Usually people buy it variegated, but it reverts to all green sometimes, and those areas are more vigorous and overtake the variegated one. And so there's a lot of just plain green bishop's weed out there, and it's got three leaves. It's a little tricky. They're the variegated bishop's weed. You got a little shape of poison ivy, but I've very good. But the all green one can really fool you into thinking that it's poison ivy. And take a few photos and send them my way, michael@saverlife.com, and I'll try to identify that for you and keep you from having to itchy rashes on your skin for most of the summer. I haven't heard any reports of giant hogweed, but that is a plant that you also need to be aware of. Basically, if you see something looks like Queen Anne's lace, but on super steroids, just, you know, it can be 6-8 feet tall, and has that sort of umbelliferous flower that are, again, like, but instead of being maybe 3 inches wide, like Queen, that group of little flowers, the giant hogweed might be 2 to 3 feet wide, that same group of flowers. So much, much, much crazy how much bigger it is. Huge leaves, green stems with red splotches on it. You look it up online, you'll see some photos. There is a lot of it around New York State. The DEC has been working to eradicate it, and I'm not sure how much success they've had. They may be at least keeping it from spreading a lot, but it's going to be very hard to eradicate. One plant can produce 100,000 seeds, which is just an insane number. And then those get spread, not through the air, but through the water. They'll, you know, rain like we had today. We'll wash those seeds, and they'll go down the hillside or down along a stream, and it really spreads very effectively. If you see, you're supposed to alert the DEC, and they'll send out a crew to try to eradicate it. It's much worse than poison ivy and what it does to your skin. And it's very tempting to go pick these big, huge, like, I don't say bouquet. I mean, 3 feet wide. It's like a plant from outer space or something. It's kind of crazy. But that's how people get in contact with it sometimes, is they want to cut one of these stems and bring that with them. And the oil in the leaf will affect your skin in a much more devastating way than poison ivy. In fact, it's a phototoxin. And so if you get on your skin and your skin is exposed to the sun, not just today or tomorrow, but for like the next couple of months, it turns your skin black. I mean, it's really disgusting. Really not something you want to get into. But there's enough of it around that you really need to know what it is and show examples of it to family and friends, maybe your kids or grandchildren, so they know what it is and so they don't get into it. It'll make your life truly miserable, and you'd be wishing you had only poison ivy. Giant hogweed is the plant to avoid. Also, saw a note in the Democrat and Chronicle, article about gypsy moth is emerging as a huge pest in Ontario County, Bristol Hills, and this is devastating. It's not going to, probably not going to kill that many trees, assuming it doesn't stick around that long this season and doesn't come back too many more years. But as the article says, it often does come back for at least another year, and just defoliating the trees completely, like every green speck is gone. It's a very eerie type of feeling to be, you know, walking in the woods and then suddenly it's like winter. The oak trees and things that just have no leaves. It's insane. It really is. So this is happening now in Ontario County. I don't know how far it will spread. There's not a lot you can do about it, especially in a forest situation. And again, the trees will leaf out again. If the caterpillar has another generation or smaller ones that are still feeding and they defoliate the tree a second time this season, that's going to be a problem for those trees. But usually the trees will leaf out again. They'll produce more energy to get them through the winter and into next year. And then we'll see if this gypsy moth comes back. But I have just sharp memories, distinct memories of biking on Cape Cod through areas where these gypsy moths were feeding. And as described in the article in the DNC, you can hear their excrement dropping through the trees and onto the ground. They're just tiny pellets, and it sounds a little like rain. But it's not rain. It's kind of this macabre reminder of what's happening up above. So you can also sometimes even hear them chewing. It's nuts. And sometimes they'd be hanging from, they can make a sort of a spider web line that allows them to swing from tree to tree. And so sometimes they'll be hanging down from these trees and you're biking along and they're like right in your face. It's crazy. It really is. So be aware of that if you are down in the Bristol Hills area. And like with a lot of other pests, be a little aware so that you don't go home with gypsy moth caterpillars on your car, on your clothes, say in your hair. But do a quick check. Just, you know, I don't mean a microscope to every piece of your car, but do a quick check, because it's very easy for them to fall out of a tree or, you know, swing down on their spider web line from a tree and onto your car. And if you bring those to another spot, you know, it could start an infestation where you live or some other place that you visit. And you know, if you have a trailer or if you, I don't know, camping gear or whatever might be outside that you're bringing into your car and bringing home, and it's more, it's awareness. It's kind of like when you have a boat and you take it out of a river or a pond or a lake, you want to clean around the motor. You want to check the sides of the boat, any crevices that might have some invasive plants. You want to get those off. There's more and more signage at the boat launch areas around New York State, because this is how invasive species get moved around. So again, it's awareness and just being careful, and hopefully that the area in the Bristol Hills will not get devastated too badly. There, it can take out, you know, whole hillsides of trees, the foliage off those trees. It's really extraordinary. And again, it's just a, you know, pest that comes and goes. We've had it here before, and usually what happens is the numbers get high, and then the population crashes, often due to fungi that eventually attack these gypsy moths. There don't seem enough birds that like them. Maybe they're not very tasty, but the population does eventually crash. It's a matter of whether it's 1, 2, or 3 years. It can depend on when, you know, there's specific point in as they're maturing, or you know, if we get a lot of rain and the right conditions for fungal attack on these gypsy moths, that will contain them. So a lot of it's weather dependent, and also the survival of the trees depends on the weather too. If we have a drought year, it's going to be much harder for them to leaf out again. There'll be more trees that succumb to it. As I was driving on 490 just yesterday, I was going out to Bergen Water Gardens, and there are so many dead ash trees as you're on 490 between here and Churchville exit. Extraordinary number of dead ash trees. And that's the ash borer, which, you know, as flies and move through this area and has wiped out most of our ash trees, and they're still standing, but more and more of them are going to be falling because they've been dead for a few years. But just a reminder of kind of Mother Nature and this constant battle of insects versus people, not to mention viruses versus people, but these insects. But it is out to Bergen Water Gardens. They are got tons of lotus. They're just some of them are just starting to bloom. Some stunning flowers, just really amazing flowers. So the plants are still relatively small, makes them easier to bring home. I also have some really neat carnivorous plants. It's not going to eliminate the flies in your yard or around your area, but you'll get revenge on some of them. I could hear a fly buzzing while I was near these carnivorous plants and one of these pitcher plants, and you could look in and see the fly caught down there, and then it's digested by the plant. It's crazy. So you can set up a little garden of carnivorous plants. You can, there are a lot of ways that you can use them. These are generally not hardy, so you'd have to bring them inside for the winter. But I've never seen such a large selection of carnivorous plants, and Birch and Water Gardens is doing a lot with them. They also have koi, and they have some beautiful tropical water lilies, some they just got in from Thailand that are actually hardy, but very colorful shades of red and purple. And their season is really just beginning at Birch and Water Gardens. Cold spring held back the lotus and their demonstration gardens, but they're starting to grow, and looking forward to a colorful summer out there. If you have comments and questions, you can email me, michael@saverlife.com. I'll be back with For the Love of Food, 10 a.m. this morning. Check it out at saverlife.com. Have a great day.